Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonsoir tout le monde. Good evening everyone. I will switch to English. It's a great honor to have Harold Varmus here with us to give us the first of a series of four lectures. I have to say that I feel that I've followed in the shadow of Harold for many, many years, because when I started as a PhD student at the ICRF, my PhD supervisor told me that the desk that I was being given was where Harold Varmus had sat as a sabbatical visitor. So he was already legendary to me when I was in my early 20s. But I'd like to say a few words to introduce Harold. I think many of you, all of you, know him, of him. So perhaps I'll start with the fact that in 1989 he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine together with Mike Bishop for their discovery of the cellular origin of retroviral oncogenes, or more precisely, for demonstrating that cancer genes, oncogenes, can arise from normal cellular genes known as proto-oncogenes. He actually started out working in E. coli and then worked on tumor viruses and the RAS sarcoma virus in particular, and then went on to make his seminal discoveries. And he continued both very actively scientifically to make huge contributions, but also he's been an incredibly active person in the context of, I would say, scientific policy, scientific organization, science in all its senses. And I think this is why he chose to give this series of four lectures on the reflections on the scientific enterprise. So I will swiftly give a little bit of background about his various positions and what he managed to do. So he joined the Mayo Cancer Center of Cornell as the Lewis Thomas University Professor of Medicine in 2015. He's also an associate member of the New York Genome Center, where he helps in developing cancer genomics programs, and he's also an adjunct professor of Columbia University, where he teaches undergraduates about the scientific enterprise. Before that, he was the director of the National Cancer Institute and president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for 10 years, where he enlarged its research and patient care programs and constructed a major new research tower, initiated the first independent doctoral program in cancer biology they had. So wherever he goes, he makes big changes, big impressions. He was then appointed by Bill Clinton, in fact, to become the first Nobel Prize-winning director of the NIH, where he spent six years. And there, he managed to hire some of the top researchers as directors, and he helped to initiate a doubling of the NIH budget and established PubMed Central, which I'm sure all of us know, which is a wonderful free archive of published papers. So open science well before its time. He actually was a graduate of Amherst College and Harvard University in English literature, not French, but I'm sure he has a bit of that too, and of Columbia University in medicine, and he actually went on and trained at Columbia University Medical Center and then the NIH, as well as UCSF California, before he became a member of the basic science faculty of UCSF for over two decades. Harold is a member of the US National Academy of Sciences and of Medicine, and he's involved in numerous initiatives to promote science and health in developing countries. He serves on many different advisory boards for several academic, philanthropic, governmental, and commercial institutions. And right now, he's the co-chair of the Mayor's Life Science New York City Initiative, and he's members of advisory boards of the Broad and of the Crick Institutes, as well as the Global Health Program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and two biotech companies. And more recently, he became the chair of the World Health Organization's New Science Council, which is actually one of the places where he and I regularly meet, and also the co-chair of the National Academy's Committee on Science, Technology, and the Law. He's authored many, many papers, of course. He's written books. And maybe I could just say, something that most recently he was involved in. He was the co-chair of Barack Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, as well as being a co-founder and chairman of the board of the Public Library of Science and chair of the scientific board of the Gates Foundation, Grand Challenges in Global Health. He's contributed hugely, both to science and to the scientific enterprise, and it's really a huge honor for the Collège de France to host you, Harold. So please, if you'd like to come and join me, I will award you your medal, which hopefully you can put somewhere on your mantelpiece of many, many other awards and medals.
Thank you. Well, there are two moments of gratitude here. One to the Collège de France, which has invited me to come to this magnificent hall to talk over a series of 4 weeks, and to spend a month with my spouse in Paris, the best thing since Jack Kennedy brought Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris. That's bringing my wife here. And the second thank you goes to my friend and colleague, Professor Edith Hurd of the Collège de France, for nominating me to do this. And I think, as you probably have gathered from what you've heard from Edith, this invitation came at an interesting time in my life. I spent about 20-some years running various institutions. And when I stopped doing that in 2015, I began to teach undergraduates, as well as continuing to run a laboratory, by thinking a little bit about how science actually works, how it contributes to society, how society sustains the activity of professional scientists. And I did this by talking to people who sometimes were science majors, sometimes interested in scientific careers, sometimes students of philosophy or economics or political science, who simply wanted to think a little bit about how science actually works. And I've been doing this initially at the Honors College at the City University of New York, more recently at Columbia University. Most of these students, many of them immigrants, children of immigrants, who are entranced by the idea of what American science does and are thinking about joining the troops. And in the course of those discussions, we talk, of course, about how science is financed, how it's regulated, what society expects. But we also talk about how the ranks, the labor force for science is generated. And obviously, if you're going to practice science, you need to recruit new people to do it. But it's a very funny dynamic. The labor force for science is hard to regulate in the right way, to have the right numbers of people. So we go through periods of hyper-competition to periods of insufficient talent going into the discipline because it appears to be terribly competitive and a less easy way to spend one's life. So I decided to contribute the first of these four lectures to the question of what inspires someone or what makes it possible for someone to join the scientific workforce. And that is the topic of the first seminar. Obviously, a lot more to say about this. But the question is, who becomes a scientist? Why do they become scientists? And I'm going to illustrate this in various ways, but most especially by talking about my own somewhat strange route to science, to illustrate that there's no predetermined course that gets someone into the profession to serve the enterprise. Just as a foretaste of what we'll be talking about the next 3 weeks, because I'd like to think that some of you will come back for another dose. And next week we'll talk about more of what's expected, that is, what have I done as a scientist? How did the work that my colleagues and I have done change the way we approach cancer? And there, too, the interaction between science that's born of curiosity about how things work meets closely with societal needs to improve the way in which we prevent and treat cancer. And I will try to illustrate how the organization of the scientific enterprise makes it possible for somebody working with what seems to be an esoteric problem of how a virus in chickens causes cancer leads ultimately to the development of new therapeutics that are affecting the lives of people with cancer every day. In the third lecture, I'm going to talk a little bit about a very important aspect of the scientific enterprise, how we share results with each other, and how they're published, how results are shared in other ways, what we do with the publication process that makes it a very contentious practice. And in the last lecture, I'm going to talk about what science means for the poorer parts of the world. What are our obligations as scientists to ensure that the fruits of our labors are used to the benefit of people who don't have the resources that are needed to run a scientific enterprise? And how do we ensure that people of talent all around the world have the ability to participate in the enterprise? And I'll give you a number of examples of what is being done to do this. And my goal here is to inform, to justify the Collège's commitment to let me come to Paris for a month, but it's also to entertain. And I hope that some of the stories I have to tell will be things that you'll find useful, entertaining, and fun to listen to. I need to begin a little bit of philosophizing about science, what it is and why people do it. And I'm certainly not a philosopher of science, I'm not a philosopher of anything, but I've been doing science for a long time and I have some sense of what it is. And to me, you know, the enterprise is one thing. It's complicated, it's social, it's economic, but science at its fundamental is a state of mind. That there was a time thousands and thousands of years ago before anybody had any notion of what a laboratory might be or a scientific journal, when people simply looked up at the sky and saw spots of light and realized they could use those to imagine what the greater sphere of things might be and how to orient themselves on the bit of land that they, how they might keep track of time and monitor seasons and weather and adjust agricultural or hunting processes in the same way. And that state of mind is one that's based on certain kinds of activities, gathering evidence and thinking in a reasonable, logical way about what that evidence might mean. We tend to think today about science as performed by somebody who's working in a white coat in a laboratory, but of course, there was a long history of making observations and trying to draw logical conclusions that was based simply on observations, nothing that involved experiments. And the introduction of experiments gradually by Francis Bacon and other people in the 17th, 18th centuries was a new phenomenon that departed from the traditional idea of simply saying, what kinds of animals and plants are out there? What kind of rocks are there on the ground? Why do the seasons change, and how can we mark the passage of time? And there are, of course, a lot of varieties of scientific work when you take this very broad approach to thinking about it. We tend to think about, most obviously, about the natural sciences that I've been alluding to, especially the life sciences, which is what I've done and what I'll be focused on in these lectures. But there are also social sciences, and I call them sciences because if they're approached by gathering data and trying to think logically about what that data predict about the future, these are serious sciences. Science can be practiced as in a private mode or a public mode. There are many variations on those themes. It can be a for-profit activity or a not-for-profit activity. It can be a solitary activity, but more commonly these days, it tends to be organized into partnerships and laboratory groups and teams, even huge teams that are devoted to things like sequencing the human genome. And that is what most of the enterprise is about. Now, Charles Darwin, arguably the greatest scientist of the 19th century, is an interesting guy in this respect because he was half amateur, unorganized, outside the enterprise and partly within it. Sure, he belonged to scientific societies. He corresponded with many of his thoughtful colleagues and wanted to persuade them, as we all do, that his theories were right. But he was also an amateur. He lived out by himself south of London in Kent at Down House with a family legacy that allowed him to do interesting experiments, as I'll show you in a moment, and never had any dependence on outside organizations for funding. But like all of us who think as individuals who are interested in how things work, he recognized that science was not simply a solitary activity. It was also a solitary activity that led to observations and conclusions that needed the confirmation of the community. And that's an interesting feature of science in general, that it works when people exert their individual genius, but also seek the approbation, the confirmation, the support of a broader community of people who are thinking about the same problem. But Darwin, whose life is perhaps most beautifully described by Janet Brown in this wonderful two-volume biography, went through a phase in which the passage between, the difference between amateurish, non-establishment, non-enterprise activity is seen in contrast with a more professional enterprise-like activity. He and his son Francis spent many of the last years of Darwin's life trying to understand the sensations felt by plants and their responses to sensations. So he did this all by himself with his private money, working in a greenhouse on his own property at Down with very primitive instruments like the one shown here. His son Francis was aware of what was going on, especially in Germany, traveled to Germany to meet with botanists who were using much more sophisticated instruments, working in centers for the study of plant science, sharing results, competing with each other, and doing the kinds of things that Darwin, as a solo scientist, somewhat apart from the enterprise, was trying to work. And he, the son Francis, became quite frustrated with his father. But it illustrates the dichotomy between amateur science that doesn't require the interactions with society that are demanded by someone who is dependent upon financing from societies or governments. In thinking about why one should become a scientist, it's worth saying a thing or two about its value, because we're in this lecture today considering why somebody would become a scientist, and obviously to recommend that someone do that, it's worthwhile saying something about the value. In my view, having done this for a long time, the greatest core value is the way in which science exercises our humanity. The idea of knowing things and expressing them and using the things we know to make life better. But science also has more pragmatic values, especially trying to defend ourselves against the things that make life difficult, like disease, like hunger, like a need for water, enemies in other countries, other tribes, other the other in general, now climate change and deficiencies in our energy. But it's also making commercial products, which is a simple monetary goal in which science does have great value for many people. And what's more complicated, however, is thinking about the things that affect our choice of science as a profession. And here's where the multitude of opportunities come to me as your lecturer today, because there are a lot of things. Personal experiences, as you'll hear when I talk about one of my topics, chance, serendipity, but also aptitude, ancestry, family traditions, family wealth. And then there are other people who affect us as we mature, teachers, mentors, people we admire in various ways. And then what is often forgotten is the cultural context. How much does our society encourage us to become scientists? Is being a scientist and contributing to welfare through science a national aspiration? Do concerns about the future of a society or a country depend on aspirations for scientific solutions? And then a lot of these things get represented to individuals through the arts, especially books and films, and I'm going to mention some in just a moment. So I can't talk about all these things, and you don't want me to talk about all these things, but I do want to take four excursions that explore some of these features of how people make a choice about what kind of life to lead and whether that life should include work in the scientific establishment. And I'm going to give you four examples. One comes from the arts, from the work of a fiction writer who wrote a novel called Arrowsmith, made into a movie. I'm going to give you a little bit of taste of what that was like because it provides a way to think about what it's like to make choices in a scientific career and what those choices portend for the outcome of life in a society. Secondly, I want to talk a little bit about this background feature, the cultural feature provided by the politics of a country. And I'm going to talk a little bit about U.S. history and its ups and downs and the current uncertainty as well. And then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about serendipity and use my own history. I didn't have to be a scientist. I could have been something else very clearly. And the fact that I became one is a matter of some chance, and it's entertaining, at least to me. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. And then I want to talk a little bit about barriers to becoming a scientist, illustrating that by the demography of American science at the moment, where the representation of ethnic and racial groups still is appallingly poor. So first, about inspiration. A lot of people say, in answer to the question of why'd you become a scientist, I read a book that was really great. Some might say I read about Charles Darwin in the book I just mentioned a moment ago, or I read about his adventures on his incredible five-year voyage to South America and the Galapagos, and what he had to say about the origin of species that completely changed the way people think about mankind and about how biology works. Others might say I was inspired by a really profound question, and one that many great biologists have pointed to is the very short book by Erwin Schrödinger written in the 1920s. Schrödinger was a physicist who realized that there was potential violation of the laws of physics in living systems, and he stated the problems that he saw them as a physicist in ways that galvanized the ambitions of many physicists to move into biology and people who weren't yet scientists to take up science. Last year from this podium, you heard my friend and colleague Paul Nurse talk about a book he's recently written with the same title, What is Life?, exploring some of the same themes almost 100 years later. In my own experience as a medical scientist, many point to the writings of two important authors who were interested in public health. One, Paul DeCreef, who wrote a book called The Microbe Hunters, which describes the work of seminal microbiologists like von Leeuwenhoek and Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch and many others who identified the infectious causes of diseases, and even lacking a deep understanding of how cells actually work, were able to develop vaccines, in some cases drugs that were useful in fighting those diseases. Bertrand Rucher was a writer for the New Yorker magazine who wrote many essays about public health that had similar effects upon readers. But as I've already indicated, I want to talk a little bit about a somewhat different kind of book, a book of fiction written by a famous, indeed ultimately Nobel Prize-winning American novelist named Sinclair Lewis, who learned from Paul DeCreef, the author of The Microbe Hunters, about developments in microbiology that were leading to improvements in public health. And he devised a story that illustrates many ups and downs and choices that are involved in a career in science, telling the tale of a young man named Martin Arrowsmith, a farmer's son who aspired to a career in medicine, but then saw choices, as you'll see in a moment, in science and in public health that led him to attempt to cure one of the great plagues of all time, the disease called plague, bubonic plague, that was afflicting, in an imaginary, fictional sense, people living in the Caribbean islands in the 1920s. And that was made famously into a movie in 1931, starring Ronald Colman and Helen Hayes. And I'm going to illustrate quickly from that movie how three mentors influenced Martin Arrowsmith's thinking about choice of a career. Should I be a physician taking care of patients? Should I be a scientist trying to understand disease? Should I be a public health worker trying to prevent disease and think about how disease affects large populations? So in the beginning of the novel, the beginning of the movie, Martin is reading Gray's Anatomy book, and here's...
That would make a medical man out of you if anything, Will. Boy, it would make a real scientist out of you if you live up to it. Reading old Gray, eh?
Yes, sir.
That's right. Physician's Library, 3 books. Gray's Anatomy, the Holy Bible, Shakespeare. Scotty Martin, someday you may be a great doctor. Get training. Go to college before you go to medical school. Study chemistry, Latin, physics, biology. Be a fine doctor.
Okay, so he goes off to college, which is an important thing in the U.S., as it is now still true in places like England. People went to medical school without having gone to college first, so I like the emphasis on the arts as well. But this is not, of course, the only option. When Martin goes through college, then goes off to medical school, and he meets the kind of prototypic idea of a scientist in the 1920s. This book was written, it was published in 1925, just about 100 years ago, when the idea of a scientist was usually a European in a white coat, often a German Jew who had escaped or had left Europe, come to the States. And Arrowsmith goes to see Professor Gottlieb early on in medical school.
Well, I'm not going to be just an ordinary doctor.
No?
No, I want to be a research scientist like you, Dr. Gottlieb. not as great as you are, of course, but I'm not interested in just giving pills to people. I'd rather find a cure for cancer.
Yeah, if you can do that, you will be much greater than I.
No, I really mean I want to find out things for myself. I know how little I know, and I'm not afraid of hard work.
Oh, so now we begin to talk sensibly. Scientist, that is born in a man, and in very few men. It may be born in you, but first go and be a medical student. Go learn the names of the diseases. Learn to work in the dissecting school without being sick. Learn to watch the blood flow without fainting. Go and get your MD after your name, and then come back to me.
Okay, so fate has its role here. Martin meets a nurse, falls in love. She wants to go back to North Dakota, where her family has a farm, and he becomes a local physician, does the usual things, but he's frankly bored. He, you know, still has the aspirations to learn things, make discoveries, contribute to the history of science. He has an episode of helping to solve a problem that involves infected cattle who have a disease called Blackfoot. And that makes him decide that he needs to think a little bit more broadly. But first, he goes to a nearby city and hears a Swedish public health expert.
Here in India, and in China too,
from where comes the bubonic plague. I have
bubonic
seen
plague.
Village after village dying with no help from no doctor nowhere except me. I sound like pretty important fellow, huh? Well, I am. Not so far ago, the whole population of London was nearly wiped out because a little rat carried the germ of the bubonic plague on a ship from China to England. Now that could happen again. I tell you, we don't want no more old-style soldiers. We want new style. Doctor soldiers. Scientific soldiers. Yeah. That's all.
Okay, so at that point, Martin hears from Dr. Gottlieb, who has moved to a prestigious research institute, well supported by the wealthy people of New York, and he makes a very appreciable discovery. He discovers viruses that kill bacteria, including the bacteria that cause diseases like bubonic plague and many others, viruses that become called bacteriophage. But at this point, the McGurk Institute, which needs money from its rich supporters, exaggerates the significance of the discovery. And then Martin learns from Gottlieb himself that he was scooped. Scooped by whom? You should all know. The scientist at the Pasteur, de Harel, who had, I was about to say French, but of course it's not clear where Harel was born for a variety of rather amusing reasons. But Harel clearly had priority here and Martin's reputation somewhat undermined. Nevertheless, Martin continued to study bacteriophage, thinking there was the possibility of its being a great therapy for bacterial infections, and he decides to conduct a clinical trial. Half the patients get the phage, half do not, when a plague epidemic breaks out on the Caribbean island. But for various reasons that are emotional and rather impressive, he decides to abandon the scientific standards, gives the bacteriophage to everybody. The pandemic subsides as pandemics always do, but it's not clear whether the bacteriophage has anything to do with it. He returns to the fame that's cooked up by the McGurk Institute, but at this point, Martin understands that he has failed the scientific golden rule, and he runs away from the McGurk and goes into the wilderness to try to practice science in rural Vermont, adhering to standards, high level of integrity, but without what we would call the scientific enterprise. So this book lays out the richness, the potential of a scientific career, and was influential for many of my friends who chose to go into medical science. Before I come to the question of my own life and with serendipity, I want to talk a little bit about how science societies promote an interest in science as a profession, just quickly reviewing what the view of science has been in the government of the United States. Because there's no doubt that for the most part, in our history, our leaders, our political movements, the notion of international competition, and to a certain extent, collaboration, have encouraged the growth of the scientific enterprise, but on occasions, as you'll see, have threatened it. So we consider ourselves a product of the Enlightenment, a movement that was born largely here in France, and two of our founding fathers, Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, were both what we call Francophiles, spent a lot of time in Paris soaking up the idea of rationality, evidence-based thinking, freedom from religion, and America, to a very large extent, was founded on those principles. without going into detailed history here, I just point out a couple of extraordinary moments. 1963, in the middle of our Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, who's thought more of, thought about more as a log splitter than a scientist, nevertheless did a number of extraordinary things. He founded the National Academy of Sciences. He commissioned the Transcontinental Railroad. He established what are called land-grant colleges that are very dependent on agricultural science. And this so-called miraculous year of Lincoln's in the middle of the war was a triumphant moment for American science. At the end of the campaign for his fourth term, Franklin Roosevelt, favorite president in my own history, went to the NIH campus and dedicated a new building, giving a speech that has been legendary for those of us who've worked many years at the NIH, saying that we cannot be a strong nation unless we're a healthy nation. A healthy nation requires scientific work of the kind done at the NIH. And even more importantly, Roosevelt recognized by the end of World War II that science had made a number of incredibly important contributions to the success of the U.S. and its allies during that war through development of radar and the expansion of antibiotics like penicillin. And he asked his major science advisor, the man who had run the scientific enterprise at the for the U.S. government during the war, Vannevar Bush, an engineer from MIT, to write a report about how this could continue after the war with a marked increase in government investments in science. And he asked Vannevar Bush to establish a framework for thinking about how to do that. And the framework Bush delivered to the next president, Harry Truman, was actually very simple and still pervades the way in which science is conducted in America today. The U.S. government, through the NIH, the National Science Foundation, and many other organizations, would pay for basic discoveries that were mainly made at universities or private research institutions, and that then the commercial world would be able to make use of those inventions to come up with the practical applications developed in the private sector that improved the lives of our citizens and provided commercial benefit. Another important moment occurred on my first week as a freshman at college when the Soviets launched Sputnik, encouraging our president then, Dwight Eisenhower, to say, wait a second, we can't let the Soviets outmaneuver us. We have to invest more in education, science education and scientific activity. That led ultimately to Jack Kennedy's declaration that we were going to send a man to the moon. Part of this, of course, national competition with the Soviets, but also an ambition to place America in the forefront of scientific exploration the training and the investment in space exploration and the sciences required for that were an illustration of how the leadership of a president like Kennedy can make a huge difference. A few years later, one of Kennedy's political rivals, Richard Nixon, held in disrepute largely these days, signaled his commitment to science to benefit health by signing the National Cancer Act. I'll say a little bit more about this next week, which markedly increased the resources available for cancer research, reflecting a commitment for the government to support biological science as a way to try to get control of a dread disease. In the years of George W. Bush, many of us thought that because of some somewhat eccentric statements made about stem cell research and other kinds of scientific activities by George Bush, that science was under siege. As you'll hear in those of you who come to my fourth lecture, George W. Bush is now recognized for a lot of insight into how people in poor countries can benefit from investment in science and the application of principles of treatment against AIDS through the PEPFAR program. But he was followed by Barack Obama, who was perhaps the most committed of all the presidents I've been acquainted with as a day-to-day science groupie, and who used to enjoy coming to White House science fairs and meeting with young children. But on this day, in 2015, he announced a precision medicine initiative standing next to a copy of the Double Helix. We've had one period of difficulty in which a president who threatens to return to the White House in 2025 made a series of preposterous statements that persistently undermined the scientific enterprise, and no more needs to be said about this at this time. So culture sets conditions that improve the likelihood of people becoming scientists. Individual decisions, of course, are necessary for people to actually do that. And I want to illustrate this in a rather self-centered way by talking just briefly about my own decision to become a scientist, which was a complicated and coincidental one that definitely depended heavily on serendipity. So briefly, my father was a doctor, my mother a psychiatric social worker. The remarkable feature about that is that they were both the children of immigrants, of poor people who came from Eastern Europe. My childhood, somewhat unremarkable, living in Florida during World War II because my father was assigned to an Air Force base there, lived as a frequent visitor to the Surfside, and when my father returned to Long Island to practice medicine, and as the son, the Jewish son of a physician, not surprisingly, I went off to college thinking I was going to be a pre-medical student, but once there at Amherst College, I became much more interested in literature, did a thesis on the work of the famous novelist Charles Dickens, and had actually decided to go on, did go on to graduate school in English literature at Harvard after my graduation. But here, serendipity intervenes, because in the summer before I went off to graduate school, I teamed up with one of my closest friends at Amherst, who had been the winner of the biology prize that year, a fellow named Arthur Landy, who had a subsequently distinguished career as a biologist at Brown University. But he won a prize that allowed him to attend an international congress of biochemistry in Moscow. Now, there are a lot of meetings, a lot of places, but this was a very unusual meeting because this was the first time that the Soviet Union, under Khrushchev, was allowing so-called Darwinian-style scientists to come after the deposition of an agronomist named Lysenko, who had undermined Soviet science and Soviet agriculture, leading to massive famines during the 1930s. The first time that so-called Darwinian or Mendelian science was being talked about in the Soviet Union. And here are some mementos from that meeting, which is now recognized as being a very significant moment in the history of science and the history of politics. Not just because Lysenko was forgotten for the moment, but because this fellow, Marshall Nuremberg, a famous NIH scientist, gave a remarkable talk in which he announced the first elements of the genetic code. And let me explain why that was significant. Just 8 years earlier, Watson and Crick had shown that not only was DNA what was arguably the material of that conferred genetic information from one generation to the next, was not just in the form of a double helix, but that these two strands were base paired in a way that suggested that the base pairing was determined by the sequence of the four bases of DNA, and that the replication of these strands could be could be determined by their order and by the necessity of pairing of A's with T's and G's with C's. This is stuff that I suspect everybody in this room is already familiar with, and I don't have time to go into it in great detail. But one of the great mysteries is what was trying to understand the nature of the information. How could just a series of chemical entities with the labels A, C, T, and G convey information that would allow the cell to do what it does? And that question was often referred to as the coding problem. How does DNA encode, for example, the composition and the sequence of proteins? And during those years, Francis Crick and others determined that information flowed not just from DNA to protein, but through an intermediate called RNA. And this notion of information flowing from DNA to RNA to protein has become fundamental to biological science ever since then. And what Nuremberg showed was at Moscow State University in 1961 was that at least one triplet of bases provided the code for one of the amino acids, one of the 20 amino acids. And from then on, it was possible to define how every combination of three nucleotides would specify either a specific amino acid that would end up in a protein, or a start or a stop site in the coding of proteins. So this was something that happened to me before I went to graduate school, but when I came back to graduate school, the excitement of this announcement by Nuremberg kept ricocheting through my brain, and was not equaled by the excitement that I felt reading the metaphysical poets or learning Anglo-Saxon literature. And I kept thinking, maybe I'm missing something by sticking with literature when things are happening so rapidly in science. And when I got to medical school, and this is only an historical picture that will probably amuse my wife, that shows me chatting in a classroom in 1962 with one of my classmates, the guy sitting next to me is named Robert Lefkowitz, who went on to win a Nobel Prize about a dozen years ago for his work on a set of important proteins called G proteins. But nevertheless, it just shows you that I actually was there. And one of the things that happened when I was at medical school was exemplified by the influence of a great teacher, Paul Marx, who taught me a long time ago that not only was science exciting, but it was potentially really important for changing our attitude toward disease, because you could show that some really powerful diseases like sickle cell disease or thalassemia were the result of inherited mutations that changed only one, in some cases, just one amino acid in a protein. So this made you think that what I was sort of serendipitously learning about scientific advances would actually have a big effect on the practice of medicine. However, I still was committed to a career in clinical medicine, but that commitment was complicated by what our country was doing in Southeast Asia. We had followed France into Vietnam, and the U.S. military had become increasingly engaged in Vietnam during the 1960s. Many of us were deeply opposed to that engagement, and this is one example of a announcement of a anti-war rally at the National Institutes of Health that was conducted in the mid-60s. Congress was told that the Army needed additional doctors. Doctors were not signing up. And Congress decided to require service in the armed forces or, alternatively, in the public health service, including the National Institutes of Health, which provided an alternative to the other possibilities, running off to Canada or France, or going to prison. going to France wouldn't have been a bad option, but most of us, many of my colleagues who were politically disposed as I was, joined me in attempting to get into NIH. Now, I had no scientific credibility at that point. I had never done any serious lab work, and I just, but I nevertheless filed for a position at the NIH saying I wanted to learn research methods to possibly work abroad in the future, maybe enter academic medicine, all pretty vague. Nevertheless, for some reason, I was accepted to work there and happily was paired with a young physician scientist named Ira Paston, who at that point was studying something I had a clinical interest in pursuing, namely the way in which thyroid hormone was produced by the thyroid. And he was a new endocrinologist, hoping to understand by studying the biochemical basis of the release of thyroid hormone, how hormones were regulated in a healthy organ. However, while I was waiting to go to the NIH to join up with Dr. Paston, I got a phone call from him saying that he had suddenly had a change of research plans because of an unexpected experiment he had done. He had read the work of Jacob and Monod about regulation of the bacterial genes called the lac operon, and had learned that an old phenomenon that had been described by Jacques Monod at the Pasteur Institute some years ago, a phenomenon called catabolite repression, could be overcome by addition of a compound that Ira Paston himself was studying, cyclic AMP, a so-called second messenger, and that was something that we ought to work on together. Now, I knew nothing about bacterial genetics or the lac operon. I went off to the Department of Medicine Library at Columbia, where I was working, and began to read about these romantic, extraordinary French scientists from the Pasteur, Jacob, Monod, and Leveuf, photographed here in 1965, I think on the very day that their Nobel Prize was announced. And these heroes wrote in incredibly clear language and in an incredibly stimulating way about how genes were not simply passive instructions to make proteins, but were being regulated in a dynamic way to help conserve energy and perform the necessary functions of cells in a way that was obviously going to be incredibly important and understanding biological systems and disease. So I got pretty excited about this, and I was told by Ira Paston that we had a fundamental question here. This gene was being regulated by cyclic AMP, the repression of the production of an enzyme, beta-galactosidase, by glucose could be overcome by adding another small molecule, cyclic AMP, to the bacterial cultures. And the question is, how does that reversal of fortune occur? Why does expression of the gene get augmented? Is that because of regulation of RNA synthesis, transcription, regulation of protein synthesis, translation, or by stabilization of either the RNA or the protein? Very fundamental sort of questions, but answerable and interesting, and nevertheless problematic at that time, because unlike today, when any grade school student would tell you clone the gene, make some tools, and you can measure how RNAs are, how single genes are regulated. In those days, it was very difficult to study the regulation of one gene among the thousands that are present in an E. coli genome. We had to solve that problem with a bunch of sophisticated tools. And perhaps the most important day in my decision to become a scientist was a day in which I knew I had a way to measure the RNA made from the lac operon. I had an assay that worked. And without going into details, which would be inappropriate here, I'd just say that it was possible to place on a filter some DNA that represented the lac operon, and to radioactively label RNA being made by cells under different conditions, and show that one batch of cells was making tons of RNA specific for the lac operon, shown in that graph going like that, and other cells under different conditions were making essentially no detectable RNA specific for that operon. So that was powerful. I had the tools that I could use to answer questions. And there were a few tricks here that we can avoid today. And the result was that we were able to get a result. And I could show that, yes, as expected, when you induce the production of beta-galactosidase, as already predicted from the work of Jacob and Monod, the amount of lac messenger RNA goes way up. When you add glucose, the amount goes way down. When you add back cyclic AMP, it goes way up again. And not only do you have a result that's wonderful, makes you feel like you've answered a question, but secondly, you can now write a paper and tell other people in a not modest way what you've done, and you begin to think of additional questions. How does this work? What does cyclic AMP do? What kinds of other proteins does it interact with? How does the regulation process work? So you answer a question, you get excited, you then conceive a number of other questions that are also exciting and will lead, and did lead, in fact, to a lot of other important discoveries about how genes are being regulated in bacteria. So not only could I write a paper and get interesting criticism and be proud of that, but I was able also to give a talk at a meeting at Cold Spring Harbor where Jacques Monod himself was sitting in the front row nodding and even at one point asking a question. So these things are stimulatory to the ambition of becoming a scientist and play a role in the nurturing of the scientific enterprise. So I learned a lot of things at the NIH, getting there by a somewhat strange route, that a simple model like E. coli and the lac operon can be very interesting ways that make accessible answers to very complex processes like the control of gene expression. This suggested to me that things I was learning at the NIH about human disease might now be open to exploration with this kind of molecular technology. And I also got some sense of the thrill of science, that it wasn't simply a matter of dredging information out of nature, but actually asking questions and getting answers in response. Sometimes those questions and answers might seem fairly mundane, very ordinary, but sometimes profound and very stimulating. And then there was the thrill of being proud of your accomplishments and making science not simply drudgery, but something that was exciting and fun. So for me, as a result of these serendipitous moments, suddenly I was interested in doing more of it, and I will talk next time about how that proceeded by finding the right places to do the work and the right kinds of problems that were amenable to attack at that time in our history. And I went off to California to do cancer research and to make some of the work that I'll talk about next time. But before we conclude, and I know it's going to be a couple minutes after six, but we started late, I want to say something about a fourth excursion very briefly, because I've talked as though all this is possible if you have the energy and the inclination and the aptitude, but the fact is that there are barriers to access to the joys of being a scientist. And those barriers have been traditionally gender. That's much diminished, I would argue. Race and ethnicity, the financial resources that come from economic status that allow one to take a chance on a career that may be historically difficult. And then the question of history and precedence. Where do you live? Is your country supportive of science? What are the precedents in your own social and ethnic setting? So this made me reflect a little bit as I was thinking about this talk about how the Berry plan favored people like me, young, white, male doctors. Actually, a lot of us were Jewish. That might be a surprise if we knew that story in the 1920s. Folks like us prospered as a result of some of the serendipitous political other factors that I've described in my own case. Here is a group that was called to serve the nation in 1968. I'm there in the back row. Bob Lefkowitz is there. Many other friends of mine are there. As you can see, largely, entirely male and entirely white. And this was not simply an opportunity that we got and allowed us to escape the war. We remain pretty potent. Four of those people are shown here. We were all part of the Lasker Prize jury many years later. All four have made a trip to Stockholm. There was a lot of privilege involved in the way the Berry Plan worked out. The gender disparities that were apparent in that earlier scenario have been markedly reduced, at least in biomedical research in the US, not in all fields, not in all places. But there are strong ethnic and racial disparities. This is one graph that depicts some of that, showing that in relation to the red bar across the horizontal bar that indicates the percentage of the US population that is white, black, Hispanic, or indigenous, that whites enter the scientific enterprise as students, PhD recipients, postdocs, faculty, at higher than our represented proportion, whereas black and Hispanic people in particular enter at a lower frequency than expected, and the ranks diminish with time. And the result is that when you go to a scientific meeting, you look around the room, there are now perhaps 30 or 40, maybe even 50% women, but there are very, very few people who are black or Hispanic. And that is source of concern, because the US population will soon be more than 50% non-white. In fact, we've just passed that mark not very long ago, and it's getting more and more dramatic. If you believe, as I do, that diversity is good, that people of all cultural heritages have things to offer, this is not a good sign for the future of science. A group of us wrote an article that appeared in Science magazine a couple of years ago, first of all explaining the rationale for trying to work to further diversify the workforce in U.S. science, made some suggestions about larger investments could be made by various kinds of institutions, especially universities and by the federal government, in training and research to incentivize more participation by minority populations, and that there be expansion of some programs for training minority students that have been successful. The one that always comes up on the popularity chart for doing this is this program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, called the Meyerhoff Program, where a very wealthy and inspiring guy named Robert Meyerhoff got together with a wonderful leader, in this case, the mathematician Freeman Grabowski, with the cooperation of the University of Maryland, established a program with very clear goals for success, tough rules for people students who are in the program, recruitment of faculty that were very supportive of this program, and the recruitment of students who are willing to commit themselves to following the rules of the program. And the result is literally hundreds of black and Hispanic scientists, physicians, engineers who've gone through this kind of program. So let me briefly make some conclusions about choosing a career in science, comparing then, 50, 60 years ago when I made my choice, and today. I think all of us who follow the productivity of science throughout the world recognize that discovery remains not only occasional but frequent, and it's a joy like few others. there are changes in the path to becoming a scientist. The path is more difficult. It's a lot longer. I could say a lot more about that. But there are many branches and interconnections among the sciences that make life in the scientific establishment particularly gratifying, in part because our tools are so much more powerful. The kinds of things we can do, sequence the entire genome in a couple of hours, look at proteins that are present in minuscule amounts, look at the behavior of single cells when in the old days it was hard to make deductions even from whole organs. There are tools that I will discuss in my third lecture about making our findings and our materials more accessible through a kind of open science that make life a lot better. Much to our credit, basic science and applied sciences have moved closer together. It's harder to make the distinctions that Vannevar Bush made when he wrote his report for Roosevelt and Truman in the 40s. But the demands by society that pay for science for rapid delivery of applications threaten the broad inquiry of basic science in a way that I find disturbing. There's a lot more to learn, and we have to excite people to come into science to make those fundamental discoveries. And then finally, as I illustrated, the demography of science is becoming a bit more diverse, especially with respect to gender, but we have an awfully long way to go to make science the equitable profession that it ought to be. So a career in science has been, at least for me and for many other of my colleagues, a privilege with conferring pleasures on us, some benefits on society. Comes with costs and responsibilities. But ultimately, in my view, the reason for embracing this way of life, perhaps said best by your own, François Jacob, in his magnificent memoir, The Statue Within, and I'll leave you to read this for yourself because your French is a lot better than mine. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.